Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you doing today?
I'm well.
Yeah?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing great. There are a lot of words that we use, both on this show, but as a society, that we use now, that, and some of them have some meaning, and some of them have no meaning whatsoever. And there was a great article in a Restaurant Business magazine that I thought addressed some of these words, and I think that they did a pretty good job with this, and I want to address some of the terms that they use and that we see every day on the food that we eat and that the restaurant guys talk about all the time.
You're talking about the article in Restaurant Business mm-hmm. magazine. They call it the Cruelty-Free Guide. And you know, one of the things that's happening is as people try to buy food locally, sustainably, organically, mm-hmm. without added hormones, all of these words
some have meaning and some don't.
Well, and here's the problem. People are trying to come up with a new vocabulary for what it is that we're doing. And so as the new vocabulary develops, some of these words don't have legal meaning, and sometimes there are different words for the same thing. The other thing that happens, quite honestly, is as people come up with, say, a new way to farm, and we want to farm organically. Now, for the organic farming movement for a long time, if you had organically raised dairy cattle, that meant that those dairy cattle were free from antibiotics, mm-hmm. subtherapeutic antibiotics, which is putting antibiotics in the feed even when the animals aren't sick. They're free from adding growth hormone, which is a synthetic hormone that's added to cows. They're free from genetically modified or other sorts of non-organic products in their feed. And they're also raised in barns where there's enough room to move around and allowed to graze in the pasture at least sometimes and get outside. Now, that's very different from the way the corporations raise cattle. However, corporations are trying to adopt some of the methods that are organic, but not all of them, and still be able to call
right.
their product organic. And so there are people out there intentionally confusing us.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons that Francis and I decided that we wanted to talk about this today, is because there are so many words out there that are being placed in the lexicon that are being put in that lexicon in order to dilute this issue, in order to confuse you. And so Francis and I are going
to
talk about
let's get to it
first. Okay, one of the ones that we have to talk about is cage-free. Okay, cage-free is a good thing because what happens to chickens is they're put in these very tight confines. Sometimes the amount of space they have is smaller than a sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper.
So the chicken lives its whole life not able even ever to turn around, and these chickens can go mad and start to peck at the other chickens, and so very often as a result of that they have their beaks cut off, but they still raise them to lay eggs. It's miserable. So cage free mm-hmm. means that these chickens are not raised in battery cages, that they get to be chickens. They get to perch, they get to peck around.
Well, the problem with cage free though is that it generally happens indoors, which is not a natural life for a chicken.
Right.
And when we there is no third-party auditing. There's nobody checking to make sure that when it reads cage-free, that your chickens are actually cage-free.
And even if they're cage-free but kept in a concrete bunker and not
right.
allowed to get sunlight, and they've actually shown there are some people who assert that chickens who don't see the sunlight or the sunlight doesn't see them mm-hmm. don't have the same nutritional value as chickens who are out in the sunshine sometimes. That's very related to the term crate-free.
Right.
Mark, why don't you tell us about crate-free?
Well, crate-free is a similar term used for the pork farming or used for pigs that are these. Pigs are kept also in some very, very small crates where they can't turn around.
24 inches by 7 inches. Now think of the size of a pig.
Think of the size of a pig, exactly. So, they're trying to make sure that the mothers, can't can't move around and are in as little space as possible.
And what they do is they put the mother in for the entire 4 months of her gestation.
Right.
She can't move.
And in another good idea, but be careful of this one again because it's not audited. There are no compliance measures that animals are actually not in a crate or ever go outdoors or anything like that.
Let's talk about two terms that do have meaning. One is certified organic. That indicates that a product adheres to the USDA's National Organic Program, and that is compliance is monitored by third party.
That is getting diluted, and we're trying to hold on to that term for as long as we can.
But when we say the term's being diluted, we mean legally firms are trying to get the USDA to relax what they will certify as organic.
All right, we need to talk about free range, okay? Free range is a USDA label indicating that poultry have access to the outdoors. We think that's very important.
Except it doesn't say exactly what kind of access they
have. Right, exactly. So one of the things that you want to look at the farm from which your free-range chickens are coming from. We use a farm called Giannone, for which we know that the free-range chickens actually do get to spend time outside and eat the appropriate
Again,
food.
This comes down to knowing your farmer, knowing your restaurateur, knowing your grocer, and going into your grocer and saying, hey, what about this? Where does this come from?
And we also know that there are some people skirting the rules of free-range, and where the chickens get access to free range for very, very minimal periods of time.
Here's another term for you, though.
I just want to add free range. And remember, there are no regulations to egg-laying hens being free range. So there's nobody, again, monitoring that the eggs that you're eating actually come from free range chickens if you're talking about eggs from free range chickens.
Free farmed is a label indicating that animals live in a humane environment under conditions that limit stress. That compliance is monitored by third party auditing. Hormone free is a label for dairy products indicating that cows were not injected with hormones to increase milk production. This is a big one for us.
Right, it is a big one. And do you remember before hormone free became a legal label on milk? Do you remember calling the dairy?
We called the New Jersey, mm-hmm. and this is many years ago, different administration, we called the New Jersey Secretary of Agriculture's mm-hmm. office, and one of their top assistants got back to us and said, hormone-free, all milk has hormones. And I thought, you toady, you corporate toady. I'm
right.
looking for milk that does that. Not the hormones. It can have the hormones that are naturally in the cow, not the synthetic growth hormones.
And they refused to give us any information on it.
And they refused to give us information. We were looking for a list of farms, which we eventually just found ourselves, without the help of the New Jersey Department of Agriculture. Again, not this administration.
Yeah, a few years later, Google came along.
So we found a place to get hormone-free milk. When we talk about things being under siege, Monsanto is trying very hard and spending a lot of money to make it illegal to label milk hormone-free mm-hmm. or from cows that come without recombinant bovine growth hormone because they make the recombinant bovine growth hormone. Their argument, to be fair to them, is, well, there's no difference. My argument to them is,
there is a difference.
I'm a consumer. I get to decide whether there's
right.
a difference to me or not. I don't want to eat that. And if you're saying there's no difference, prove it to my friends, and maybe mm-hmm. my friends will eat that. But they're trying
but
to
I
make
choose
it...
not to.
They're not trying to make it mandatory to label contains hormones, because there is no law that says that. They're trying to make it illegal for farmers who go to the extra expense of not using their artificial hormones to label their milk hormone free.
That
and that's wrong. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Marion Betancourt. She is the author of more than a dozen books. Her cookbook, The Texas Hill Country Cookbook, comes out this fall. She joins us today to discuss a wonderful article that she read in Santé magazine, The Defining Dishes of Portugal.
Marion, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, I have always been fascinated with Portugal. I think it's, for the size of the country that it is, culinarily, navigationally,
historically
and culturally, it's had a tremendous influence on Western and European history. And I only spent a time there a couple of times when I was younger. I was visiting Spain, and I went over and I spent a couple of weeks in Portugal. It's an amazing country. What's your fascination with it?
Oh, I mean, they were the great fishermen of the world and the discoverers. So they brought, they still eat more fish than any per capita than any other European people. And if you go up and down the coast of Portugal, you can eat fish 3 times a day, and each time it gets better. And the spices they bring are from, you know, they had ships running around the world with coffee and spices, you know, 500 years ago.
So. Marion, one of the reasons that it gets better is because the breakfast fish, I've never been a big fan. So lunch is going to be a little better than breakfast was, just by definition.
Well, let's talk about a fish that you could have for breakfast. The Portuguese fish, the singularly Portuguese, that I think of always Portuguese culture, although it exists in other cultures, is bacalhau. Will you talk to us about bacalhau?
Oh, well, as they say, they have 1,001 ways to fix it, and the one way is the way that you like it. And it's funny because they kind of invented the whole preserving technique, you know, hundreds of years ago, but now they import it from Norway, but they still love it. I mean, they eat it many different ways.
I mean, it seems that other countries kind of have their distinctive way that they prepare salt cod, but
The Portuguese are obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more than just something they love. It's like it's part of their soul, I think.
Well, let's connect the dots here for a moment.
Okay.
Bacalhau is salt cod.
Yeah.
And salt cod is where cod is caught in the ocean, and back historically the Portuguese fishermen, you know, ruled the seas. They were the first great fishing fleet before the Spanish, before the British. Henry the Navigator, of course, was from Portugal. What they would do, of course, you catch all this fish in a wooden boat, and you've got to get it back to Portugal. Well, you didn't really have an ice machine on board, you know, of the wooden boat.
Right.
And so what they would do is they'd carry a tremendous amount of salt, and they would put the fish on salt. And that became the bacalhau, and that was the way to bring cod back as a foodstuff. What are some of the ways that they prepare it that are interesting?
Well, they have to first soak it. They have to get the salt out, and
right,
that's kind of tricky because it takes
salty.
Some experience to. You keep changing the water and soaking it until most of the salt comes out. But if too much salt comes out, then it's going to be very bland. But they roast it or they braise it in olive oil. They make like a stew out of it. They do many things with it. There are just many ways.
We think of salted. Like salt cod, I think, in this country, as if you don't have refrigeration, that's what you need to make do with. But indeed, it's its own delicacy. It's you know, many people would rather have bacalhau than a fresh cod, right?
Right. Yes, definitely.
Besides bacalhau, what kind of unique fish do you find in the cuisine of Portugal? I mean, I remember being there. And I was less adventurous, I guess, as a 25-year-old the first time I went to Portugal and spent some time there. And there was some pretty interesting stuff that I didn't recognize that I thought, oh my, I'm going to need to be adventurous to go to go there. What other kinds of things would you see in a Portuguese plate or in a Portuguese restaurant that you mightn't expect to see coming from our frame of reference over here?
Well, I mean, the sardines are the next big thing, and they grill sardines the way we grill hamburgers over here. I mean, that's just, you know, a ritual that goes on. I mean, you know, family and friends get together, and you go out and you barbecue some sardines.
You know, that's one of those things. Sardines, we look at sardines in this country as those little canned things
right.
that you get. And
yes.
Fresh sardines are so delicious. And for some reason in this country, we just kind of lost the tradition of eating fresh
right.
sardines. And I'm still not sure why, because they're a million times better fresh than they are in those little
they
things.
Are.
And they'll occasionally come into the market here in New York. And when they do, when they're fresh and they look good, we grab them and throw them on as an appetizer. And we have a wood-burning grill in the restaurant. We do them all the time.
Right.
They're amazing.
They are. They're delicious.
But grilling is the kind of preferred way to make sardines. How else do they use them in Portuguese cuisine?
Well, they sometimes bread them and fry them that way. I've had them in one place at the restaurant at the Pestanza Palace in Lisbon. We had the chef made a sardine, and he made a codfish coating to go around it, which I thought was kind of unique, so we could try both fish. And there are just, you know, other, and they sometimes put them in a brine and add a little spice. So there are just many ways they do that. They're just wonderful with every fish. I had one of my favorite meals was up the coast from Lisbon and Cascais. Right on the beach, there was a restaurant called Porto de Santa Maria, and they had a huge sea bass, and they wrapped it up in salt, and then they wrapped a bread dough around that, and they baked it for about a half an hour.
That sounds great.
And it was like a religious experience. The waiters carried it out like it was this most precious cargo, and they, you know, they made a whole ritual of breaking the bread crust around it, and and serving it to us, and it was just so juicy and delicious. It was wonderful.
Marion, you're talking to two restaurant guys here. It was precious cargo.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, and I have to, when I was in Portugal, I spent some time in Cascais. I spent about a week and a half there right on the beach. And my experience in Cascais was I was down there with a friend, and we were walking around in the afternoon. We saw fishermen pull up to the side of the where the little dock comes in there, where the little marina comes in there. And it was like two guys in a boat, looked like a fisherman and his son, and they had a big swordfish. Mm. And they handed the fish over to a guy on the dock, and some money changed hands, and that guy threw this big fish over his shoulder and walked like into the not less touristed area and walked into the back door of a restaurant.
Right.
We then walked into the front door of that restaurant.
And ordered swordfish.
No, and we made a reservation for that night. We came back later and had swordfish, and I ate there, you know, four nights in a row. It was absolutely amazing.
Right.
Hey, we'll be back in just a moment talking to Marion Bettencourt about Portugal and the cuisine and culture thereof. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Marion Bettencourt about the foods of Portugal. Now, I haven't been back to Portugal, I'm sorry to say. Though I've been back to Europe many times, I haven't been back to Portugal in, got to be about 10 years. But I remember that not only was the food wonderful when I was there, but it was remarkably affordable.
Yes.
And an important part of the culture, even compared to other European countries. Now, the dollar is not doing so well compared to the euro, but is it still a relative bargain to eat and hang out in Portugal?
I don't know if it's a bargain. Well, I guess you'd have to, yes, relatively. I mean, you know,
relative
compared
to the
London
rest of
or
Europe,
someplace,
yeah.
It's much better, yeah. And one of the things, and, you know, the wines are very inexpensive in Portugal, and they're really good, and we don't have a lot of experience with them over here yet because I don't think they export as much, or whatever the distribution system in this country is, we don't get a lot of Portuguese wines here.
No, you know, it's true, and that's actually a growing phenomenon. You're seeing Portuguese wines from say, the region of Alentejo, and you're seeing some white Portuguese wines that come in. I remember when I was a kid, we'd go to the Portuguese restaurant and have, you know, a bottle of Douro Red for $4.
I remember there was a place in Sayreville called, Portuguese Fisherman, was it exactly.
Yeah, and I don't think that was really authentic Portuguese cuisine, and it wasn't very good wine, but
I was 19. I wasn't an authentic drinker either.
It was, again, a bar. I think we went there together a couple
times.
We did. Hey, we're gonna go to the news, but when we come back, we're going to be speaking more with Marion Bettencourt about Portuguese cuisines. There's some things they eat there that you might not know of that are really wonderful, and there's some resources to find out about them other than just going there yourself. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Marion Bettencourt. She is the author of more than a dozen books. Her cookbook comes out this fall. It's called Texas Hill Country Cookbook. Right now, though, we're talking about an article that she's written in Santé magazine, The Defining Dishes of Portugal. You talk about some dishes in there that I experienced when I was was there, and as an American, I had some cultural inhibitions to overcome, but I really did enjoy them. You talk about a restaurant in New York, Tintol,
right,
which is a very authentic Portuguese restaurant here in America.
Yes.
But you talk about some items he makes on his menu, like the classic pork dish with boiled pig's ears and braised tripe.
Yes.
This might be a little much for the faint of heart.
I think it's a little much. When I was in Portugal, they used to put pork pig's ears, you know, and I don't know what they did to them, but they were like, they'd put little dishes of them around, you know, on the table with the bread and butter and everything else. And
I've never been a big fan of the pig's ear.
Did not like them myself.
Nor have I been a big fan of the tripe. That's
right.
I kind of refer them as ugly and stinky.
Right. But there are other wonderful things like the caldo verde, for instance, the kale soup. And with potato, and you know, that's a standard, you know, Portuguese dish, and you can get that pretty much everywhere. It's very good.
I had a friend a long time ago who was of Portuguese descent, and she spoke, of course, Portuguese fluently. And we would occasionally go out to dinner in Newark, New Jersey. And there were sections. The Portuguese section in Newark. Many
still are. It's still
right,
Iron, a very rich area.
Many people know that who live around here. But if you're not from here, one of the richest centers of Portuguese culture outside of Portugal is in, of all places, Newark, New Jersey. We would go there, and I was at a disadvantage not being able to speak Portuguese. There are sections there, especially on a Sunday afternoon, when we would go for an early dinner, where it was. If you only spoke one language, Portuguese would have been
right.
A better language to have than English.
Right.
How important is Newark, and how vibrant is that community, and how authentic are the things coming out of there?
Well, I know Jose Morales gets a lot of his Portuguese products from there,
mm-hmm.
For his restaurant. I think the Ironbound area has gotten smaller in recent years, and kind of, you know, is not as strong as it used to be. But in New England, there's also a very strong Portuguese culture.
There are still a lot of great restaurants in Newark, in that Newark area that are of Portuguese descent. And, you know, still to this day, if I'm going for Portuguese, generally I'll head to Newark.
Really?
Now, the thing that I think a lot of people lose sight of is with many cuisines, especially because Portugal is not a huge country, there are regional differences among the different regions of Portuguese cuisine.
Right.
And can you tell us about those?
I think there's some difference. I mean, obviously on the coast there's more fish, and inland there's more of the suckling pig and goat. The spices are different. The coriander, for instance, is used more in the southern regions of Portugal than in the north. And I think there's a difference also in the south they use more potatoes, and in the north is more rice, and there are differences like that. And obviously their wines are different in those regions too.
So now you have to tell me, Marion, you've gone from writing about Portugal, you write about a bunch of other issues, some women's issues, all kinds of things like that. Now all of a sudden you're going to write a book with a gentleman, Scott Cohen, I believe
right,
his name.
Right, Scott Cohen. Mm-hmm.
You're going to write a book about Texas cuisine and how similar it is, how similar Texas is to Provence?
Well, that one region of Texas. The hill country. It's around Fredericksburg.
You need to explain.
It's sort of the area between Austin and San Antonio.
So tell us about that region, and how is it like Provence?
Well, they have lavender fields and vineyards, and, you know, there's a lot of fresh produce, you know, peaches and apples, apple orchards, and just, you know, it's very much, you know, the same kind of terroir, so to speak, as Provence. And that's why that chef is there, because he just... you know, fell in love with that area because it reminded him so much of Provence.
And is his cooking similar to Provençal cooking?
Yeah, he does. I mean, he always obviously has to put a little bit of, you know, Texas in there now and then, you know, but he is basically, you know, it's Provençal food.
You know, as Americans who don't live in Texas, I think that most of us think of cattle ranches and
yes.
oil fields.
Right.
You know, that's exactly. that's our vision of Texas.
Right.
We're not thinking of rolling hills and Provence and, you know,
I know.
Tea in the morning.
Right. That's
what sort of, when you say you need to, there's Provençal cuisine where you need to put a little Texas into it, what do you mean by that? What kind of, how do you put a little Texas into the Provençal cuisine?
Oh, well, the thing in Texas is everyone thinks it's Tex-Mex or barbecue or things like that. And he might do some kind of, you know, a barbecue technique on something that, but it's not the same. It's just different because he uses different seasonings and different ways of preparing it, and he might put a little, you know, the Spanish influence in, you know, the Mexican influence in into something with a different, you know, a seasoning. I'm trying to think of something like a ratatouille that he made, and he just adds a little bit of, you know, a little spice to it.
Are there wine producing regions there too?
Yes.
And so what kinds of wines are they producing?
They make, well, their Becker Vineyards is the oldest one, I think. Although grapes have grown there forever, but they are the most established, I believe. But there is, like, you know, 50 vineyards there.
Now, my question has to be, cooking food with a Provençal sensibility is very different than what I think Texas diners would be looking for. How is the cuisine received out there?
I mean, of course, my initial thought is, okay, a 32-ounce steak with Herbes de Provence. I mean,
it's, you know. Hey, you could get that there.
Yeah, but how are they liking that? Herbes to who?
They like it a lot. I mean, it's, you know, he's in a historic hotel restaurant, and it's called Las Canarias, which is, you know, because the early settlers in that particular part of San Antonio were from the Canary Islands, and so there's a historic. It's, you know, continental kind of, you know, it's just, it's European kind of old world feeling in the hotel, and it's very popular. I mean, it's now owned by Omni, I believe, and so they're. It's a thriving area.
I think it's really counterintuitive to what we think of Texas. I think that's probably why the book is going to be fairly interesting.
Yes.
Well, and you write on a range of issues, but this is your first cookbook, right?
Yeah, but I've done a lot of food writing for Associated Press features and many stories for Sante. And, you know, I write for others, but that, you know, so I have a lot of food background.
How is the writing of a cookbook different than your other food feature writing?
Well, it's, you know, editing a chef's recipes is like, you know, I don't know how to compare that to one of the more painful aspects of life. because they, you know, they just put stuff down and they're talking to other chefs in their mind. You know, they're not realizing that when you go through this step by step, you have to make somebody... You know, the home cook has to be able to figure this out.
Sure, they're going through it step by step, but 20 of the steps they learned in cooking school eight years ago. And
Right,
and they put a little symbol there that it means to the other chefs. I mean, honestly, we have recipes that we use.
Right, of course you rice the potatoes. What else would you do?
Well, right.
it's funny, we have recipes that we use internally in-house that we just keep the historical record of everything that we do. But I look at those sometimes and I think, because a newspaper will ask for a recipe or something, and I think, I can't give this to the newspaper. It doesn't mean anything if you don't have the frame of reference of a professional chef.
Right, and it doesn't say season with salt and pepper before you put it on the grill because you season with salt and pepper before you put it on the grill.
What are you, an idiot? Of course you season with salt.
No, there's so many details, you know, the size of the pot, how long you keep it on the stove, what kind of, how much heat,
the type of pot you might put it in.
Yeah.
Does the book tell a story as well, or is it mostly a collection of recipes? I think that's a new trend, and a welcome one I see in cookbooks, whether it's the cookbook from Hell's Backbone Grill or whether it's recipes from Home from Barbershin and David Page's Vineyard on Long Island. What's the story that the Texas Hill Country cookbook is going to tell us?
Well, it's going to tell, we talk about the Texas Hill Country itself, a little bit of its history and background, how it got the way it is.
How did it get the way it was? I'm unfamiliar with completely.
Well, the Germans went there in like the middle of the 19th century to Fredericksburg, and they sort of did a lot of farming and planting things when they were there. And the terrain is nice. It's, you know, there's more trees. You know, it's not so barren as, you know, big wide open spaces are in other parts of Texas. And so and most recently, small artisan people, like they make cheese, there are goat farms and quail farms and all these things because the big oil companies and people that just got out of that business and decided they really like to...
They're rich and they want to eat well. You can say it.
Yeah. I mean, I think Fredericksburg, which is right in the center of the Hill Country, is one of the 10 wealthiest communities in the country.
That will help, you know, as far as bringing people to your community.
Well, having farms that have an audience for the food that they create.
There are more restaurants. I mean, Austin is growing also, and San Antonio has better restaurants right now. But there's, you know, it's growing quite a bit.
Well, Marion, I want to thank you for coming on our show. It's been great talking to you, and we'll look for your book, Texas Hill Country Cookbook, come the fall. We'll look for it in the fall. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:46.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi. You know, we were talking about Portugal before. Mark, I know you were in Portugal, right? What do you remember of it?
I remember very little. First of all, I was fairly young. My parents took me on one of those great bus tours where you kind of sprint from city to city. You look and you're like, there's a church. Okay, we got to go now. Everybody back on the bus. Okay, here's another church. Everybody back on the bus. Here's Olive Grove. Okay, back on the bus.
And here we're going to pull into a chain restaurant. They're all going to serve us all at once.
No, we didn't do that.
Did you eat good food?
We didn't do that. Yes, we ate some great food while we were
there. Yeah, okay, Portugal. Henry the Navigator, Lisbon, here's the beach, here's the casino, back to Spain.
That's pretty much how it went. And you climbed onto one of those buses, and you rode around all day. And I'll tell you, easily the worst way to see a country.
You ready
on
for
the
this?
Planet.
I was traveling with my buddy Kurt. We were 25. Rolled into Cascais. Found a little room, little local woman's house. Stayed for 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I had the good fortune of traveling Europe later as an adult.
Went to the
without
beach.
Without my parents.
Went to the beach. Met a lot of Portuguese people. Drank some Portuguese wine. Yeah. Then went up to Lisbon. Hung out for 4 or 5 days.
I love the idea of when you travel, staying in one place for a little while. I mean, I remember my friends and I went to Denver skiing when we were in college. I guess our last year of college, we went skiing in Colorado. And we drove from place to place every night. We went to a different ski slope, and we skied a different area.
Didn't get to know any ski place more than one time.
And, you know, it was exciting because we got to see a lot of Colorado in a short period of time. But to me, it would have been more fun to maybe go to two different places and spend some time and learn about that place.
Or to go to one, and then you know it. Then you're like, oh, yeah, I know Breckenridge. Sure. Yeah. There are a lot.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny because I had the great good fortune to be able to do that as a young person, and sometimes a little bit more as an older person. And but... You know, we went to, and I loved Portugal, and I basically was in Portugal for, I'm going to say 4 weeks, and, you know, I wanted to go to Oporto, because in Oporto is where they make port, well, it's where the port is shipped, it's the capital of port production, and I needed to go there and learn about it, and I had some letters of introduction from Kevin Zarelli as a young man, and I learned there, but I loved the city. I stayed in the city for maybe a week total.
But when you say you learned there, I mean, to really learn about a place, you know, getting on one of those cruises, and again, not that I have anything against a cruise, because I think it's kind of a neat way to travel from place to place, but to really get into a city, I mean, Francis and I have gone to Verona a couple of times now, and you spend 7 days in one place, and you learn about the history of that place, and you meet some of the people.
But let me tell you what's even harder, but more rewarding, if you're the kind of person who can do it, and I think it's easier for a man than a woman. I traveled Europe mostly with my friend Kurt, who's a novelist now, and who lives out on East Hampton, and his next book is coming out. When it comes out, we'll have him on the show. But we traveled around sort of to gain a little bit of life experience and learn about Europe. We were gone for 5 or 6 months. There were times when we split up, and I wanted to go back to Oporto because I had a meeting with another really important port guy, and so I took the train back up to Oporto. I learned more in the 4 days or 3 or 4 days that I was in Oporto alone than the 3 or 4 days that I was there with Kurt. And whenever we would split up, when you go with another American who speaks your language, you're not as driven to struggle through talking to someone who you don't know, who may not speak your language. But you, when you're out there on your own, it's scarier, it's harder, it's more difficult, but you make more friends, you meet more people. People are more likely to approach you help you.
That's no doubt about it.
And traveling alone really is a tremendous way to learn about a culture. I will tell you that it is just the opposite of, yeah, you're in Spain on a bus with 35 other Americans, and you can all talk to each other. Why don't you just stay home and watch the video? You know, because you're...
Because if you stayed home and watched the video, you would not be on the bus on a 120-degree day sweating profusely.
But you know, 20 Americans all walk into a restaurant together. What Portuguese person is going to come up and speak to you? The hustler, the pickpocket, you know? You know, you're in a group of 20 people, it's insular. You're in a group of two... It's less insular, especially if you're a couple. Like, you know, if you travel with a girlfriend or a boyfriend.
I will tell you that if in Europe, if you're not traveling by yourself and you want people to come up and talk to you, travel with a beautiful woman. It works very well.
Except it's usually men who are trying to take that beautiful woman away from you. I will remember that Mark was traveling in one country where it was not in Europe. It was in the Middle East with a beautiful young woman. And they offered to buy her from you.
They did, some camels and a couple of goats and some hashish, I believe, was part of the deal.
And
actually, as I recall, I believe that
and
was...
And Mark's thinking, my mom would never let me keep a camel. where would I keep it? All right, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We were talking... we've been talking about Portugal all day. I will tell you, the city of Oporto was one of the most interesting cities I visited, and I'll tell you why. I visited with a friend, and then we left, then I went back alone. And the thing about Oporto is it's not a very touristed city at all. We were in Lisbon, or Lisboa, we were in Lisbon. We were in Cascais, which is on the Mediterranean coast. It's actually where the Mediterranean meets the Atlantic. And you can see a blue line down the middle of it. And those cities are very touristed, and they're very accessible for tourists. Oporto is a business city. It is a financial capital of Portugal, and it's the capital of the port wine trade. And I went there, and I sort of had a little bit of an entree because I was meeting some port producers.
I mean, it's where all the corporate offices are for all the people who produce
port. But it's also rich. You know, these industries go back, and the city goes back, you know, thousands of years. And because it wasn't a touristed city, it was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating. I got lost a couple times, and I got misplaced a couple times, and I had a little trouble getting back to my hotel one night, but it was fabulous.
Think it had anything to do with the port?
It's true. By the way, if you want as people to like you, I believe, in another culture, traveling alone is great, but also you go to a restaurant and you show an enthusiasm for their food and you ask a lot of questions.
Get drunk and lose your way home. I thought that's what you were going to say to meet people.
I was in this restaurant alone in the city of Oporto, and they found out that I was, you know, in the restaurant business back in the United States, and I'd come to learn about port, and I was interested in the food. I hadn't had a lot of their food. Was eating octopus. I remember the octopus was incredible. And this out-of-the-way, nowhere restaurant right by the water in the Douro River. And they just kept bringing me port. The owner took a shine to me, and they kept giving me port. And then the waitresses directed me to some club where I couldn't understand anybody, and we were out dancing. And then I tried to find my way home. But I find that people, especially who are into food and wine, if you're into food and wine, you can even overcome a language barrier.
Well, especially you speak Spanish, and Portuguese don't speak Spanish.
Yeah, that's Portuguese. And the Portuguese, actually, some Portuguese do speak Spanish, but they don't like it when you speak
Spanish.
And
they get mad at you if you try.
Because what they say is, we're not Spanish, like, because we all mix them up. All right. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. It's 12 noon.